The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Tony.
Hey, how you doing, Gene?
Good, how you doing?
Pretty good.
I guess, unless you got anything you want to chat about, we can just get started.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we're talking music with Tony Fratarno, guitarist and vocalist for the legendary New Jersey speed thrash metal power trio Whiplash, on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. The focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies to the early 90s. Tonight we're talking music, one of the most driving and aggressive bands in the thrash speed metal underground, and originally comprised of the well-respected three Tonys, Pitaro, Scaglione, and Bono, and a veritable laundry list of musicians having passed through their ranks since. Whiplash bring their East Coast sensibilities, impeccable musicianship, and close kinship to the New York hardcore scene to the table on such classic slabs of ripping force as Power and Pain, Ticket to Mayhem, and Thrashback. And they're about to drop a new record on us that promises to harken back to the glory days of 1984. Join us for an in-depth discussion with the one and only Tony Fratarno here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we'll be talking influences, Berkeley, and the Bay Area connection. But first, just to give you an idea of what we're referring to, here's Whiplash with Power, Thrash, and Death.
Into the night, metal of the world, the ear.
Tonight, we're talking music, and we have with us the man behind one of my favorite underground thrash speed metal bands from back in the day. These guys were right there at the dawn of thrash metal, and dropped some incredibly fast and aggressive material on us that still holds the charts to this day. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud to present Mr. Tony Portaro, vocalist and guitar from one of my all-time favorite power trios, Whiplash. Tony, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of bands that were considered quite underground back when I was originally on the scene in my late teens and early 20s are now getting some long overdue respect from the internet community, you know, the kids of the original fans. So beyond increased visibility, why do you think that is? Is there just a real sense and understanding that the music of the last 20 years hasn't really been cutting it and probably won't be remembered with any great fondness down the road? Or is there something else playing into this?
That probably has a lot to do with it, but I really believe that the internet helped it spread like wildfire. You know, back in the day when Whiplash started, it was all cassette tape trading across
right.
the world. That's the only way you could get your product or your music on the other side of the Atlantic, you know. So nowadays, it's like everybody's your neighbor right next door, you know. And it's a nice, tight-knit, heavy metal world that we all are together, you know. It's really great that you got people from South America, Europe, Japan, everybody.
Yep.
And it's still sort of like an underground thing, but it's worldwide now, you know. That's
yeah. I mean, it's like the bands were out there, but we couldn't really get to each other except through tape trading. So now it's like you can actually talk to these people, and it feels really close-knit.
It does. You're right.
You were actually one of the first bands I gravitated to in the underground, alongside Celtic Frost and Creator, and then later on Bathroom and Death. But for some reason, in retrospect, I think I sort of took you guys for granted because you were local and you played out fairly often. And I regret that now because, like I mentioned when I first reached out to you, Whiplash is a band I pull out often. I mean, your albums and your demos from the period, they've never really been out of rotation in my house, regardless of whatever else I was listening to or what phases of life I was going through at the time. So how do you think hailing from the East Coast, and specifically New Jersey, influences your sound and outlook on life and music? Because there's some clear and obvious regional differences in style, focus, lyrical approach, and aggression, even in smaller subdivisions of a scene like speed or thrash metal. I mean, clearly, the New York, New Jersey stuff is much more aggressive and fast-paced. What was it about the East Coast sound that made it so different from the usual Bay Area stuff?
That's a good question, because when we started in 1984, San Francisco Bay Area bands were the biggest influence on me, aside from Richie Blackmore from Deep Purple, who was my favorite guitar player. And before I started writing originals, I copied all his songs and leads note for note. And I went to Berklee College of Music up in Boston. And when I came out of college, I started writing music. And that was when the thrash explosion in the San Francisco Bay Area and L.A. just surfaced, you know, and that was a huge influence for me. And then taking my Berklee theory and knowledge of music and my East Coast style and blending it all together made Whiplash different from every other band, I think, and it was just the perfect time for us to come out, you know. And, you know, we've been through our ups and downs, but I'm riding the wave, you know, as long as I can now. And you know, I love it. It's just in my blood. It's something you want to do for the rest of your life. And, you know, once I stop, I think I'll be dead. So
that's fascinating because I was going to talk to you later about where you developed your style from. I'll get to that anyway. But it's fascinating that you actually went to Berklee because I wanted to go there and I didn't do it. I ended up pursuing other stuff and, you know, now I regret it. But that shows why you've got such a technical – because, you know, I listen to your stuff and I'm like, this guy's a good player. You know, regardless of the music or anything that's around it, you can tell. And the fact that you went to Berklee, I'm sure that plays into it.
Definitely does, you know. I always tell everyone that I learned more in the first 2 weeks that I was at Berklee than I did in all the private lessons I took in my life, you know. So it was a great school back then. I'm sure it's even more technical and even better now. But I remember back then it was like over 5,000 a year. And now it's like over 20,000 a year to get in that place. So
they also had a different approach as opposed to something like Juilliard where it was more, you know, classical and very stiff. Whereas Berklee had this reputation for being more modernist and open to different styles, I think you could pick up more, you know, jazz or fusion or whatever you wanted to get there. So was that the case?
Yeah, it was. They, you know, they taught you all the theory, but they didn't, like, funnel you into you have to do things this way. You know, they left it wide open for you to be creative and do things on your own and take your own avenue, whatever way you wanted to take. And there's the beauty of things, too, up there. I remember, like, there would be a left-handed guitar player playing the guitar upside down, like, Jimi Hendrix used to do.
Right.
They didn't tell him not to do that. You know, he went through the whole course, the whole semester and year, playing whatever way he wanted to, whatever way he was comfortable. And nobody ever said, hey, you can't do it that way. You got to do it this way, you know. And you know, that's, you got to leave the door open for people to be comfortable and be creative and, you know, right, just the way they want to do it. You know, let them express themselves.
Exactly. But getting back to the thing about, you know, the East Coast sound, you know, except maybe for Overkill, it's always been more raw and aggressive over here on the East Coast. Even Anthrax's early material with Neil Turbin on Fistful of Metal and with Joey Belladonna on Spreading Disease was pretty raw for its day. So do you think the area influences the sound?
I'm not sure. You know, I don't think so. I really don't. I'm not sure, but in my case, I'd have to say I kind of isolate myself from other bands, and I try, when I'm writing, especially when I'm writing new stuff for a new album, I kind of don't want too much of an influence from the outside. I want it to be my own style, so I kind of, I'm cautious when it comes to that. But I'm not sure how other bands feel about that. Maybe, I would think if there was some kind of East Coast influence thing, maybe they would all have to be listening to other East Coast bands and say, let's write like that. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure how that creative writing process would really tie into a specific geographical area. I don't see that really happening. But, you know, maybe it's in your blood. Maybe it's what you eat. And, you know,
that's what I was wondering, if it was just, you know, living in this area, because, you know, you've got more traffic, you got more people, everybody's a little more brusque than they might be in different parts of the country. You know how it is.
That is a good point. That is a good point, because it is such a fast-paced lifestyle here in the tri-state area, you know, so
right,
you don't have time. I mean, you're not supposed to be texting or talking on a cell phone in the car, but in this tri-state area, you got to be doing two things at once to get anywhere, to stay in that rat race and stay at the top, you know.
Now, getting back to what you had mentioned about Berkeley, which surprised me, now your playing style and the level of musicianship on the part of all of the three Tonys was of a much higher standard than most similarly minded bands of the period. I mean, you can really hear Tony Bono's complex bass lines, especially on the live material on Messages in Blood, and Tony Scaglione was highly thought of across the scene. Both Slayer and Massacre grabbed him for stints in their bands, filling in for Dave Lombardo on tour for a bit with Slayer, and with the intended second album from Massacre, The Second Coming. In the liner notes for that record, Cam Lee states in no uncertain terms that he felt that Tony was the only man for the job. So how did you guys all just gravitate together? Did you actually pick these guys up from Berkeley, or did you just luck into finding three really good musicians?
Back then, it was like 1982 and 83, I came out of Berkeley, and I was with some friends that played instruments, drums and whatnot, and I started writing then. Then through Montclair State College radio station, WMSC, there was a DJ called Gene Corey, the Metal Maniac.
Right.
And Tony was in, Scaglione was in a band called Jackhammer at the time. He was in the neighboring town of mine. I'm in Clifton. He was in Passaic. And Gene Corey introduced me to Tony. I guess he's seen the talent that Tony had and seen how good he was, and he wanted me to meet Tony. So he arranged something. I went over to Tony's house where he had his own rehearsal studio, and he had his band playing. They were three-piece with nobody singing, and there was a microphone sitting there. So I said, you know what? This sounds really good. I said to myself, let me get up there and, you know, belt out some vocals. And I never sang before that. So it sounded pretty good, you know, and 2 weeks later, I get a call from Tony, and he's like, hey, you know, would you be interested in joining the band? We want you. And I was like, I thought about it, and I was like, I'll do it. So for a while, I kept both bands going, but that was a pretty much a turning point in my life where I realized, you know, you can't just be in a band with friends. You have to surround yourself by the best musicians possible if you really want to take it to the next level. That's what I did. We pretty much cleaned house with the rest of the band, and Tony Scaglione and I ended up getting Tony Bono on bass, and that's when we started Whiplash in 1984.
Right. It's actually fascinating you mentioned WMSC, because that was one of the main stations that I was listening to hear bands like Whiplash back then, back when Billsy Bub was DJing and guys like the Axeman and Angel. So that's exactly, like, you're right in my ballpark here. Now, in a way, it's almost surreal to compare a band like Whiplash to a band of misguided corporate raider types that they became. And given how much things have changed since, I actually had to sleep on this before coming to this conclusion, but Whiplash may or may not have been somewhat influenced stylistically by Metallica's Kill 'Em All record. You can even kind of surmise that you named the band for that song, as there's some similarities in terms of the speed, the raw guitar sound, the raspy vocals from that album. And I have to clarify, but that album's sound was pretty much all Dave Mustaine's influence, and it's kind of accepted among the older crowd that once they ran out of Mustaine songs and no longer had Cliff Burton's sense of melody offsetting things, the band totally jumped the shark after Garage Days in 87. But at the time, they did cast a huge shadow over the scene, so it seems like it could be a plausible theory. My question is, what's the reality of the situation? Was there any influence or crossover there?
Oh, definitely. All of the San Francisco Bay areas were a big influence on Whiplash, and that time was a great time back in 84. And I should also mention that after Power and Pain came out, we never played one live show before the album came out. We had written contracts from six different labels, and we ended up going with Roadrunner. But then we did our first show ever outside of San Francisco in Oakland, Berkeley, at a place called Ruthie's Inn. We headlined, and we played with Possessed and Death Angel.
Oh, nice.
And Metallica was in the crowd. Cliff Burton was there. Exodus was in the crowd. Gary Holt. And it was awesome. I remember the day before the show, we went to Debbie Abano's house, who was managing Possessed at the time, and Exodus, I think. And we seen videos of the crowd from Possessed live shows, and they were insane. It was just crazy. And Toby Rage, I remember that guy. He was like climbing over the top of people on the crowd, like walking on their heads. It was insane. And we never seen that before, but it was a great show, you know, and that was really the start of the first show Whiplash ever did, and you know, it was pretty groundbreaking, but it always seemed like, you know, we were just below making it big, you know, and still to this day, we just set our goals and move one step up the line and hit a goal and reach it and keep moving forward, but we were the, like, most underground band of our level, you know, just hiding behind the scene and never really got that notoriety that I think we really did deserve. And
right.
I agree with me there.
No, it's true. I mean, being in this area, you know, it was always Whiplash playing out, Whiplash records everywhere in the stores, but, you know, you could tell that it was more of the underground kind of thing as opposed to something like the Big Four, you know, Metallica and Megadeth. And, you know, so, yeah, you're exactly right with that. And that's what I was saying. You guys are getting the respect now, I think, that you deserved back then. This time, but.
And I think it's a good time for us, not only because, you know, thrash metal is really picking up again, but at the same time, we're coming out with this new album called Old School American Way, and the songs are very much like the style that I was writing back on the first two albums, Power and Pain and Ticket to Mayhem, and that's what people wanted, you know. I went through a lot of band member changes and different people singing, and like I said before, when I stepped in with Tony Scaglione's band Jackhammer, I never wanted to be a singer. I never thought I was a singer. I still don't think I'm a singer to this day, and I hate my voice, but we got good reviews when we sent the demos out, and I couldn't find somebody to sing the way I wanted it done and what I heard in my head. So I ended up doing it myself, and when we got the good reviews, we just said, all right, let's just stick with it. We got to keep moving forward. Let's get a product out there, and we did. And then through all the changes that I made with different band members, it never was really as popular, and I don't know if it's because of that or just because I really don't know why, but what the Whiplash followers really wanted from day one was three-piece and me singing again, and that's what I'm back to doing, you know.
Right.
So I think this new album, Old School American Way, may be the one that really makes us more successful than we've ever been before. So I hope it works out that way. But, you know, when you're on this side of the fence, that's all you could do is do your job and hope and just throw it out there and, you know.
And, you know, when it does come out, when it does hit, I'll be happy to have you back on to promote it some more.
That would be great. I really appreciate that.
So going back to this thing we were talking about with the Bay Area scene, I was thinking that, you know, I was waiting to hear what your answer was, but I hear strong stylistic ties between Whiplash, particularly in the early era, like you were mentioning, the first couple albums, and the first Metallica and Megadeth records, which, you know, to my opinion, are still the best of their careers. They're the only albums from those bands that I still pull out and play constantly. So something was in the air at that time. With our special guest tonight, Tony Pataro of Whiplash. Coming up, we discuss Jackhammer, demos, and do some guitar tech. I'll be here on Third Eye Sound. We'll be right back.
This is Sandy Sledge from Sledge Leather, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Crank it. Metal up!
And right now, off Power and Pain, this is Last Man Alive. Back to the early days. In the beginning, there was Jackhammer, which was originally Chris Odd on vocals and guitar, Tony Scaglione on drums, and Rob Harding on bass. And that first demo, Lethal Injection, has a bit of a reputation due to Chris's odd vocals, but I actually like that demo. You know, the music is sort of a proto thrash with heavy New Wave of British heavy metal influences. You just have to laugh at some of the falsetto he's doing. But you come into the mix in the second demo, Rain Saw Love, also on guitar, but replacing Chris on vocals. I find that demo to be a bit of a mix between the first Whiplash demo and the first Jackhammer demo, stylistically. It's very much in line with where you'll be taking things shortly. So tell us a little bit about the Jackhammer era and what led to the dissolution of that band. Was it really just the fact that you wanted to go straight ahead with Whiplash?
Yeah, I think so. You know, what you just said really makes me want to hear those demos again now, but it's been so long. It's probably nearly 30 years since I've heard them. But yeah, I think Scaglione and I knew that we had some special chemistry brewing between us, you know, and we wanted to take it up a notch. and I don't think we had the tools that we needed at the time, and we decided to make a move and take it to the next level. Not, I don't want to say anything bad about Chris or Rob or their playing or anything, but it's just something that me and Tony felt had to go to the next level, and that was something that we decided to make a move, or a strong move like that, you know?
Right, I get you.
If you see my track record and all the people that have come and gone, when I feel like I have to make a move, I do it, you know?
Yes.
I would fire my mother to make the music sound better.
Yeah, you know, that's actually been evident.
If any of the old Whiplash band members are listening, don't take offense. I love you. You know, you're still my brother. But, you know, I had to make a move. I had to move on just for the music. The music comes first, you know. And they know that. I'm friends with 90% of the old band members that I had, you know. And they're always welcome to come over and work in my studio, step on stage and sing songs with me when we're playing local. And, you know, they just know what kind of guy I am. And
right.
The music comes first. And I have to do what I have to do when it comes to the music.
I hear that. Let's talk with Whiplash demos, two of which are on CD with the Messages in Blood album. I found this album a bit odd in one respect, because while I can understand why the Jackhammer demos were passed over, and you do get Thunderstruck and Looking Death in the Face on there, along with some good live material, why was the Fire Away demo ignored for the compilation?
That would be a good question for Scaglione, because he was the one that really compiled that stuff. I'm really not happy with that album at all. I mean, when I consider how many albums Whiplash has out, it's like 7 to me, not 8, because that album should have never been released. I really am not fond of the way it sounds. It you know, it was just put together really quick to, you know, if I would have heard the final product and had some say about it, I would have scrapped the whole project.
I actually hear that a lot with bands where they've got like an early live performance or a demo compilation album out. Most people aren't satisfied with it, and they say, well, you know, one of the band members just did a quickie deal and there it is, and I'm not happy with it. You're not alone there, for what it's worth.
You know, it's funny though, sometimes when we do pre-production, like in my rehearsal studio or my project studio, I should throw a Concrete Island out there. But some of the stuff we come up with in the studio in the past, and then you go and record the album, and you listen back and it's like, well, you know what? That pre-production might have sounded better than this. You know, it's like
right.
It rivals it. Even with 3 or 4 microphones on the drums instead of putting the whole full-fledged budget into it, sometimes it works out better with that raw sound with just, I don't know what it is. You know, maybe it's
true.
Too refined by the time you get in the studio. It's over-rehearsed or something, but a lot of times, just that raw, live sound works better. You never know what's going to happen.
Exactly. And I'm from that school. I tend to prefer, not always, but I tend to prefer the demo and live sound where it's more raw than the stuff that's in the studio. Because, like you said, sometimes the production just cleans it up and sweetens it too much. You know,
right.
They put a layer of syrup on top of it.
Yeah.
So now you get signed to Roadrunner and bring the better part of the third demo's tracks along with you to Power and Pain. Now, Burning of Atlanta and Respect the Dead make it onto Ticket to Mayhem, as does the early live track Eternal Lies. But it takes until Thrashback, which was essentially the Whiplash reunion album with the three Tonys again, before some Thunderstruck tracks make it to vinyl, King with the Axe, Thrash Till Death, and the early live track Killing on Monroe Street. So why was so much material left locked away in the archives for all those years?
I think over the course of time, after those demos, we were just moving forward and steamrolling, you know, and that's all we had in mind. We never thought about going back and redoing any of those older songs. But then when we got back together, the three Tonys, we were like, all right, let's write new material. And then I'm not sure even who brought up the idea, probably Scaglione, saying, you know, let's include some of these old songs that we had. And it was a lot of fun re-recording them and actually changing lyrics and using old titles with new music and just mixing the whole thing up, like throwing it in a blender and seeing what came out, you know?
Right.
But I'm glad we did, you know, because some of those songs people really like King with the Axe is
right.
People like that song. And well, we do Killing on Monroe Street live every show now, which is a really fun song to play. And that song is about Monroe Street. You're from the area.
Yeah.
Monroe Street, you might know, in Passaic, where Capitol Theater used to be on Monroe Street. One day we used to rehearse like 2 blocks over from Monroe Street. And one day I was going to rehearsal and I seen this crowd of people chasing this black guy down the street, you know? And when I got to the rehearsal, I was like, all right, I got to write this song, Killing on Monroe Street. kind of like a true story. I don't know if the guy ever got killed, but...
Power and Pain, besides being an incredible record and a real linchpin of the underground, thrash, and speed metal scenes, was blessed with some interesting background vocals. You had some guys from Carnivore and Agnostic Front both pitch in. So was this just some East Coast solidarity?
Yeah, you know, we had shared the same manager at the time, Connie Barrett, and Carnivore was on Roadrunner also. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what label Agnostic Front was on, but she was able to drag them in, and we're like, hell yeah, let's get Pete, you know, Pete Steele sang on there, and I can tell you a good story about that. We're doing background vocals, and everybody is crowded around the microphone, and Pete's voice, he's so tall and big, and his lungs were so strong, we had to make him step back about 3 feet, and everyone else was crowded around the microphone, and we had to push him back a little because his voice was so strong and heavy, you know. It was awesome.
It also shows the crossover that was going on between the punk and at least underground metal scenes at the time.
You're right. You know, back in the 80s, in the mid-80s, when we were doing tons of shows at L'Amour in Brooklyn and CBGB's. Between the two of them, that was like our two home bases, you know. And CB's was more of that hardcore punk going on at the time. But, you know, what is still strange to me, I love the fact that all of these hardcore New York bands, like Agnostic Front, Crumbsuckers, all of them bands, took us under their wing, you know? We were the three Tonys from Jersey doing thrash metal, yet they took us under their wing like we were part of their crowd, you know? It was really cool of them to do that. And I remember just about, 3 weeks ago, Agnostic Front played here at Dingbats in Clifton, New Jersey.
Right.
And I went down there, and I seen Roger, you know, after about 28 years, I haven't seen these guys.
Wow.
And I said, hey, I'm Tony, you know, from Whiplash. And he was like, oh, did Vinny see you yet? Come on backstage. Vinny, you know, so we went backstage and took pictures and everything and had a great time. And
awesome.
It was a lot of fun being reunited with them guys again.
Yeah, and I mean, you even tapped into that with the song Stage Dive, you know, because at the time, that was new to the metal scene, but punks have been doing it for years.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, this also had a bit of a flip side at the time with a lot of confrontation and violence at shows with punks versus metalheads and vice versa. Now, given that there's always been a close kinship between the styles, with punk bands respecting and often trying their hand at metal styles and metal band members coming out of and respecting punk, what do you think that was all about? Because it baffled the hell out of me.
Yeah, it is strange how those two styles, there was like a brick wall in between, you know? It was like the Berlin Wall. And then all of a sudden it got knocked down and everything started filtering together, you know? You're right. And I don't have any explanation for it, but I'm glad it happened.
Yeah, that's for sure. Because like I said, it was just really like, well, we're all kind of in the same boat. Why is there fighting going on? But like you said, it all healed up eventually, and now it's practically the same thing now.
Yeah, I remember, you know, you had to watch what color laces you were putting on your boots because it meant something back then, you know?
Exactly. What kind of guitar amp pedal setup were you using? Because you get the pinched harmonics on the single note riffs and solos, and there's a brightness to it. But there's also almost a tube-amp sort of hollowness to it. You know, the guitars never really get that thick, fat sound that thrash became known for. Like I was trying to get it earlier, the lineage is more thrash speed from, like, the first Megadeth Metallica records to stuff like Agent Steel and Snow White. So how did you get that sound? What were you using?
I usually, back in the beginning, I would always go directly into the head and not use any pedals at all. And then
really?
I was always using a Marshall head with groove tubes. I had it customized by a guy called Kenny Fisher from Trainwreck Circus. But he's not alive anymore. God bless him. But that was my pretty much trademark sound. I would always avoid pedals and go directly into the head and not use a lot of distortion. I was able to... Actually, when we did our first tour in Europe with Sodom, I think it was in 88... I'm not sure. 88, I think. We shared a tour bus with Sodom and everything. And Frank Blackfire was on guitar. He told me that my sound was so clean yet so heavy. And that stuck with me, you know, so clean yet so heavy. I like overdrive, but not a lot of distortion, you know, because I'm real right-hand heavy. I do a lot of like 16th and 32nd notes with my right hand where I break a lot of A and D strings, which is not normal. Most people break a high E or something like that, but I break the thicker wound strings because I lean into it, and it's actually like hacksawing the string on the bridge. So what I have to do to all my guitars, I put graphite saddles on so that the strings don't break at the saddle anymore, and that's the way I could get. I could put a. If I didn't do that with graphite saddles, I could put brand new strings on right before the show, and I'll break an A string or a D string before the end of the show.
Wow. It's funny, too, thinking about guys like you that you're saying you actually played clean and right through the head, because nowadays people are really going for, like, I guess, like the death metal sound where it's super overdriven and they've got the process solid-state sound, or they're going through Pro Tools or whatever. And hearing your sound, I would never think it was clean. I just thought it was unusual. I was like, why is he getting this interesting sound I'm not hearing anywhere else?
I think, you know, that was the BC Rich guitar that I have was Neil Moser wired it. He was Jimi Hendrix's go-to guy, guitar technician. I think the bass switch on there and some of the electronics that he has, that sound really came from the guitar itself, and no pedals involved whatsoever.
Wow.
Hey, yeah. I got another story for you real quick. Let me throw it in there. So we did that 70,000 tons of metal cruise in January this year.
Right.
And it was incredible. But I brought my girlfriend with me, and we were sitting by the poolside watching Exciter. You know, I grabbed a couple lounge chairs and carried them over. We're laying back in the sun, like 85 degrees. Here we are about 40 feet from the stage with Exciter playing, loving life.
Right.
And I get up, and I said, let me take some pictures of these guys. So I go up closer. And I look and I see Clammy, the bass player, and he's got a Neil Moser bass guitar. I recognize the logo on the headstock. I'm like, oh my God, I got it. Because I just talked to Neil on the phone 2 weeks before because I was having a problem with my BC Rich bitch. So I said, I got to meet this guy. And sure enough, later that night, we walk into the dining room area, which was really cool because it's like a 5-star dining restaurant. And you're sitting down eating lobster and filet mignon, and you got Ozzy Osbourne cranking through the speakers. It's incredible. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Everyone has to, you know, put your money aside and go on one of these 70,000 tons of metal or barge to hell cruises. But I walk into the dining area, and the first table, I see Exciter sitting there. And I was like, oh, I walk right up to the bass player, and I said, hey, is that a Neil Moser bass you're playing? And he's like, yeah, yeah. And we hit it off so well. You know, the guy's so cool, Clammy, like for the whole rest of the cruise. And now, in fact, on Friday, he's coming down. He's riding his Harley down from Canada, and he's staying with us at our house and probably going to lay some bass tracks down. We'll see what happens.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Tony Pataro of Whiplash. Coming up, we discuss album art, Tony's hot sauce, personnel shifts in the 90s. Coming up, Third Eye Cinema. Another one from Whiplash of Ticket to Mayhem. This is The Burning of Atlanta. We'll be right back. Now, there was a clear progression with every Whiplash release, not only in terms of the demos, but there was a major change between Power and Pain and Ticket to Mayhem, because Mayhem was a lot more cleaner and more produced. I tend to really focus on Tony Scaglione's double bass drumming on this record. Now, what makes this very impressive to me is this was before Triggers, right? Because if that's true, you really only had Dave Lombardo, Gene Hoglan, and Tony doing this sort of thing at the time, assuming my memory's correct. They were certainly the best drummers out there back then.
Yeah, I don't remember using any Triggers on any of the Whiplash albums, but it could have been. I'm not sure. But yeah, Scaglione, he's definitely in that upper echelons of drummers, and I really wanted to get him back. And we spoke on the phone one day, and he was totally up for it. He's like, I can't believe you got Whiplash back together, and you didn't ask me to do it. But I said, you know, the door was always open. If you would have came to me, we would have done it, you know. But I said, you want to do it now? And he's like, yeah. And I was so excited, and he was so excited. The hair on my arms was standing up. And we were thinking, who are we going to get to play bass for this project? And the first person we thought of was Rob Machete from MOD. Now he's in Generation Kill with Rob Dukes. And it kind of fizzled out. Gaglione told me, you know, like about 2 weeks later, that he couldn't do it for one reason or another. I never really asked him what the reason was. Whatever it is, it's personal with him.
Right.
That's when I got the new lineup because I had three shows in England set up and one in Dublin, Ireland. So I called up Ben Ward from Orange Goblin. Ben, you know, who could I get out there to play drums for this string of shows that I got? And he suggested Nathan Perrier. But Nathan was just starting a business at the time. And Nathan said, Dan Ford is your man. So I called up Dan, and Dan was just out of that band Sick, SKYTH, SIKTH. Very progressive band. They played in Japan and everything, and he's a great drummer. He taught drums at the Academy of Contemporary Music in the UK.
Right. Aren't they one of those djent math metal type bands?
I believe so. Very progressive. I mean, great musicianship. Dan's roots are in thrash, so he immediately said, I'd definitely do it. I'm in, you know. And
Right. And
then those shows in Europe got canceled, and Dublin got canceled, and I fired the booking agency, and Dan was the best thing we got out of it, you know, and he's totally in 100%, and he's
awesome.
A drummer. He makes it so easy and comfortable for me to play live. I could concentrate on singing and running around the stage, and it's just, he's the man for the job, you know, that's all I think.
So who designed the covers on your records? Because Power and Pain, the artwork is so primitive. Back when, we used to laugh, but in retrospect, it's actually pretty effective. You know, it really does symbolize the content with, you know, a fist of metal crushing some poor guy's skull.
That was Sean Taggart, you know, and I still keep in touch with him through Facebook. And this past, in 2011, we actually did a Power and Pain tour, and we resurrected that artwork and had it done digitally on t-shirts, and it came out great. I mean, it looks like a million colors, and you see every little speckle of everything on it. I sent Sean a t-shirt too, and now we don't really know who we're going to use for the artwork on Old School American Way. You're making me think I should give Sean a call.
Well, it's a thought. For Ticket to Mayhem, you have a more, I'm going to put this in quotes, professional looking, but still a bit cheesy, kind of like claymation-style diorama. I used to really like this cover, but like I said, my taste has changed over the years. While this one's much more polished, I still find Power and Pain to be the better cover in its own art brute sort of way.
That's cool. Yeah, the difference between those two was the first one, Power and Pain, was like a painting, a drawing.
Right.
Second one was actual models, like made out of, like, I guess, wood and, you know, balsa. You could see the fence.
Right.
And everything. And with the lighting, it was just a picture taken of the model, which I like, too. I like the album covers. But then we moved on with the Cult of One. You look at that and Sid, Stan, Neil, Pray. My daughter's on the cover of that one. And those are just really professionally done pictures. And I really prefer pictures over artwork, or I did up until now. I'm not sure what I'm going to do next. But I do like that high-quality photograph.
Right.
But believe me, I've been looking at so many different artists right now and that do cover art for albums. And I have a list of about 300 of them, and I've been digging through it, and I narrowed it down now to about 30.
Right.
I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet, a drawing or a picture, but it has to fit with old school American way. But it's,
yeah, what I was going to say, for what it's worth, my 2 cents, is that the newer style is more the photography, like you're saying. But if you really want to go for that old school vibe, you kind of have to go for art, because even up through the days of death metal, it was always some kind of drawing, and that's what always drew you in. You know, whether you're looking at something like Celtic Frost, or, you know, even bands like Cirith Ungol, where they were kind of stealing those Michael Whalen covers from the Michael Moorcock novels, it was always some sort of art going on. You had the Dan Seagrave stuff with the death metal, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
That just says old school to me, for what it's worth.
You're right, you're right. And the last album that we did, Unborn Again, was Ed Repka, who did Death and Megadeth. He's incredible. He's fabulous.
Yeah, Dan Repka and Dan Seagrave were like the big guys at that time. I totally remember that. And I was actually going to comment on that cover when I get to it. So here's a weird tangent, for just to pull things off to the right for a minute. I understand you're involved in the creation and or marketing of a hot sauce.
Yeah, we do have a line of hot sauce, 3 different styles. We got 2 habaneros. No, 1. Yeah, 2 habaneros and 1 jalapeno. That was from a company up in Canada. We're not really working with them anymore, so we have a limited amount left, but it's hard to distribute because we can't get it out. You can't send it outside of the United States, so it's only really available in the States right now. It's modeled after some of the song titles of the albums. Power and Pain is the devastating hot sauce. You don't want to eat that first before you eat your food, because you ain't going to taste anything else after you eat that.
You get your head crushed.
All right. Last Nail in the Coffin is my favorite. Last Nail in the Coffin is like a kind of fruity kind of flavor, and it's great on pizza and everything, you know. So,
awesome. Where do you sell these? Do you still have them?
We got them on the website. Sometimes we'll bring them to live shows and sell them with the shirts.
Let's move on to insult to injury. Now, the musicianship here is excellent, but it was a major change. I remember a lot of people saying how this was your best record, and there's some really excellent musicianship across the board. But to my ears, it sounded like you moved into a more mainstream thrash sound, particularly with Glenn Hansen on vocals now. And Tony Scaglione was out of the band, replaced by Joe Cangelosi. So what happened with Tony, and why did you start recruiting other singers from here on out?
Okay, well, Tony actually came up to me one day and said, listen, I got an offer to join Slayer. What should I do? And I said, wow. I was kind of like, if they offered me a spot in the band, I might think about taking it. You know, I didn't tell him yes or no what to do, but that's all I said. And he ended up doing it and did a 7-week tour with them, which was really great. But he was the one who told me to check out Joe Cangelosi. He might be a good replacement for himself.
Right.
So I did, and it worked out nice in the beginning. And insult to injury, at that time, I really wanted to focus on my guitar playing. I really wanted to work on my leads and my songwriting skills. And like I said earlier in the interview, I never liked my vocals. I didn't consider myself a singer.
Right.
And it seemed like the right time to make that move. And Glenn did a great job, and he's still a brother of mine. I love the guy. And, he, you know, the stage is always open door for Glenn to jump up and sing a song. But, and in fact, the only song off of Insult to Injury that we play live now is the title track, Insult to Injury. And I sing it, and it's one of my favorite songs to play live.
But what was with the move to the chunkier thrash sound? It wasn't the older whiplash kind of, like the thin sound I was talking about. You were suddenly getting this, you know, the traditional Bay Area sound on this album.
I think that was probably done in Tracks East in South River, New Jersey. I know we did Cult of One there, and that Cult of One is my favorite guitar rhythm sound of all the Whiplash albums.
Right.
But I really don't remember the circumstances of the recording of that album. I'm not sure.
So after this, you took a 6-year hiatus and came back with Tony Scaglione, but lost Tony Bono. And what was more strange is you changed vocalist again, this time to Rob Gonzo, and changed your sound so that you came off more like, and I apologize to people that are fans of Dimebag Darrell, but it sounded more like Pantera if they had a better guitarist. So what was this all about? I mean, you did it for Cult of One and Sit, Stand, Kneel, Pray with Warren Condidi on vocals. There was some clear technical ability in the guitars, but it wasn't exactly the Whiplash I knew and loved.
You're right. It took a turn. I don't want to say it took a turn for the worse, but it took a turn to a more technical sound. And Warren, it was a big part of that. And he's another brother of mine, you know. I just actually talked to him yesterday, and he got back to me today, too. He was texting me, and we're working on a new idea for a new wah-wah pedal. But I can't talk much more about that right now.
Right.
Yeah, Warren is, you know, I always said with Whiplash, I would never work with another guitar player unless he was at least as good as me. And Warren is an incredible guitar player. And the stuff that we did on those two albums, the way we traded leads and did harmonies, was as good as anybody did. As good as Maiden, you know. And if you've seen us live back then when we were in our prime and we had those songs down tight, you would not be able to deny that. He's just an incredible guitar player, and he's working on some new stuff now, and I can't wait to hear it. I haven't yet, but I'm sure it's going to be incredible.
But were you just following the 90s, like, okay, this is where everybody's moving now, so let's go with this kind of a, like a Pantera-type sound?
You know what? I think that Pantera sound came a lot from Rob Gonzo. He really liked that sound, and he was a part of the songwriting back then on the Cult of One album, right?
Right.
And, yeah, he really had that groove, and he does to this day. If you listen to any of his stuff, he was in that band Smoke. He really has that Pantera groove. And even his vocal style sounds like...
Yeah, it was. It was very close to that.
And now another story I could throw in here really quick, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
We played in Hellfest. We played in France. 2011. Last year, yeah. And I was hanging out backstage, and I see Phil Anselmo talking to about six people, you know, surrounded by six people. And I knew for a fact that he's a big Whiplash fan. Years ago, when Sabbath had one of their reunion shows here in Jersey, somebody threw a bunch of flyers up for... the March Metal Meltdown that was going on in Asbury Park. They threw flyers on the stage, and he picked one up, and he started reading through the bands that were playing. And when he gets to Whiplash, he's like, Whiplash, Tony Scaglione on drums, the local guys, you know. And I'm in the crowd all the way back, you know, about 50 rows, and I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe this is happening, you know. So I knew he was a Whiplash fan. So when I see him backstage, I waited till I had an opening, and I was all ready to go on stage with my beard braided and my buffalo carved Indian skull beads in my beard and everything. And I walk up to him, and I said, you know who I am, but you don't know me. And he just goes, he said, look at this guy. You know, he starts playing with my beard, you know. I'm Tony Patera from Whiplash. He's like, oh, man. He whispers in my ear. He's like, hey, you got to come back and hang out in my dressing room, but don't tell any of these people. So later on, we went and hung out, and he's cool as hell. Great dude, man. We were just partying, you know, drinking, having a good time. Hell of a guy.
Listen to the Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Tony Pataro of Whiplash. Coming up, we'll discuss Unborn Again and the upcoming album. And here on Third Eye Cinema. Off Thrashback. This is Thrash Till Death.
We'll be right back.
So you got the old gang back together for Thrashback, the Three Tonys back in full effect, complete with some old demo and unreleased live material in tow, and some very classic sounding tracks like Stab and Memory Serves. Your vocal style had changed a bit, but it's still recognizably old school Whiplash. I really like this record. But around this time, we lost Tony Bono, and other than the Messages and Blood compilation that we talked about before, it was the last we heard from Whiplash for about a decade. So what made you decide to get back together with Joe Cangelosi for Unborn Again?
Unborn Again, like I said before, I kept the door to my studio open for anyone who wanted to come back, all the old Whiplash members. You know, I never stopped writing music. I never stopped recording. And Joe called me up one day and said, hey, look, it's a good time to do this now. Everything's, the fire is burning, and let's get on board.
Right.
So I'm like, you know what? I've been waiting for this call, so let's do it. You know, so he came down, and we wrote that whole album in about probably between 7 and 10 weeks. And then we got the deal with Pulverize Records and flew out to Berlin to mix it. And, you know, I like the album. I'm not really 100% with the production, but, you know, I can't blame that on anyone. That's a lot of my fault, too. But, you know, I'm really looking forward to this new album now, because this material that we have 10 songs written already.
Right.
Like I said, it's really focused more towards the real old school three-piece Whiplash from the first two albums, and
awesome.
That's what the fans want, and that's what I want to give them. You know, I want everybody to be happy. And just like last weekend, we played in Columbia, and when you look at these people's eyes in the front row, and you're on stage, and they forget about all their problems, no matter what they are, and they're just having a great time. You know, that's what keeps me wanting to do music and playing live for the rest of my life, just for everybody to have a good time. And going back to Hellfest, I remember talking to the promoter at Hellfest, and he was telling me that in 5 years, they have 3 shows a weekend. It was 5 years, so 15 shows. I'm guessing about 60,000 people.
Right.
So that's like 180,000 people times 5, probably close to 1 million people. And there was not one fight with the heavy metal crowd.
Awesome.
And I remember even wandering around drunk with a pitcher of beer in one hand at the end of the night. And it's a huge, like, it's gotta be about 20 acres land. And I seen all the food vendors there. I'm walking by and I'm like, oh, look at that sausage, looks good. Look at those French fries. But I didn't want to put my beer down. Oh, I'm really hungry, but hell with it. So I bump into this guy, and the guy falls on the ground, and his French fries spill all over the floor.
Right.
I'm like, oh, and over there, like, if anyone falls down, everyone goes to pick him up. You got 6 people trying to pick you up, and they don't even know who the hell you are. It's just the heavy metal crowd. It's just so friendly and everything, you know. Everybody's out to look for a good time. But this guy goes down, and he picks all his fries up and puts them back in his little cardboard container. And I'm like, dude, let me buy you more fries, man. I'm sorry. He's like, no, it's my fault, man. I'm like, no, let me buy you some fries. He's like, no. I'm like, well, here, take 10 euros. He's like, no, man, it's my fault. And he walks away with his dirty fries, eating them.
Wow. You had, like I mentioned, that 6-year period between a couple albums there, and then you had a 10-year break between Thrashback and Unborn Again. So what have you been doing in your off time? Are you still doing studio work? Are you involved in other, you know, businesses? Or?
Well, I turned my studio into the public and started charging and recording people. But, you know, one of the reasons why I put an end to Whiplash for a while is because we had a bad deal with the record label.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, we were having fun writing music, all the glory, everything, you know. It was a great time, but it turned from all of that fun and glory to a business.
Yeah.
And the record company was the one making all the money, and it was a business now. And here we are doing all the work, and we realized that, you know. It's like, what's going on? And
right.
That was when, you know, you just wanted to get out of the contract and just put an end to it. It took all the wind out of the sail.
Yeah.
You know, it worked out to the best, I guess, you know.
So getting back to Unborn Again, it's got a nice cover on it. You got the homage to Insult to Injury with the guy on crutches, and then Ticket to Mayhem since you're at that carnival. But instead of a skeleton, you've got a curvy blonde and Daisy Dukes giving out tickets. You've also added a multiracial touch than you might have expected back in the day. The attendees seem to be quite diverse. And then you've got the track Firewater on the album with producer Harris Johns doing a Native American chant. So what inspired this one? It's very much in the vein of what Redbone was doing back in the 70s.
Wow, that's cool. That's good. Well, like I said, we threw that album together. We wrote in about 10 weeks. You know, it was good to have Harris Johns involved, and I love the fact that he did that chanting in Firewater. In fact, I feel like hearing that song now. But
So what inspired that, though? You know, were you listening to a lot of Redbone and just figured, hey, let's try it, or, you know, where to come from?
I couldn't name one Redbone song for you right now, to be honest with you. But I don't know. We just get in the groove, and we, like I said, again, like I said before, was, you know, I kind of isolate myself from everything so that I don't have too much of an outside influence.
The album also shows a fairly diverse mix of the classic thrash sound around Insult to Injury and more of a blues rock thing, because I'm hearing Mountain and Sabbath and all sorts of those 70s rock influences in there. Do you see yourself going more in that direction as the years go on?
No, I don't. I absolutely don't. But you're right, because we did, when we were in Berlin mixing the album, somebody from Rock Hard magazine came down and said exactly the same thing. It has that, like, 70s influence in with Unborn Again.
Right.
I don't know. I think these new songs that we're writing are more, definitely more like the old school Power and Pain.
Awesome.
And like Metallica, like you said, you know, like their first couple albums, you know, it's right down to the roots again. Strip everything off of it and just go right back down to the roots.
I'm looking forward to that one. Because, you know, I was thinking that if you were going to be heading more in that direction, I understand, because, you know, I used to be very much the thrasher, and I still listen to all that stuff, maybe more now than ever, in fact. But if you hear my playing on the show bumpers, and especially at the close, you'll hear that I paired things back to more like a jazzy, classic rock sort of feel. And I think it's just a function of maybe age and slowing down a bit. I don't know what it is. Do you feel that with your own plan that, you know, you might be moving back towards earlier influences and simplifying things a bit rather than charging in at full throttle like you used to?
Well, it's a combination of both. It's definitely moving back to the old stuff, but keeping full throttle with it, you know. I'm still doing those 32nd notes on the A string and the D string and note riffs like the Burning of Atlanta.
Right.
But I want to keep it raw, like Power and Pain, you know, as close as I can get to that at the same time. You know, you're going to hear my note riffs, and even while I'm singing, my left hand is all over the place, and my right hand is like a chainsaw on the string. So,
right.
You know, that's a difficult thing to do. I mean, a lot of people that try to copy the Whiplash songs, and maybe, you know, I wish, looking back, I wonder if I should have made it easier to play when I wrote these songs. You know, I'm 51 years old now, so I'm playing this crazy stuff, and people that try to copy it have a difficult time doing it.
Right.
And they're not playing it right, and I could see that on YouTube videos. But I'm trying to teach them. I put up a couple tutorials to show them how to play Power Thrashing Death right and everything.
I actually saw that, yeah.
But once you play it right, try to sing it and play it at the same time. Not
yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. I know you just headed out to a show in Columbia. Are you going to be doing more touring, you know, especially once this new album hits?
That's what we're hoping for. I really want to get this album out before the end of the year so we could get on all the major European and South American festivals. I think just the fact that the album is being recorded and going to be out might help, but you know what? To really get that album out before then, I think we got a really good chance of getting on all the big festivals. And this is the time for Whiplash to make it, you know. I'm doing everything I can to get it out there on time. You know, I want to be proactive with everything we're doing now. And the songs will speak for themselves. I'm not worried about that.
Right.
It's just the timing, you know. The timing has to be right. And that's, you know, that's my main concern right now.
I'm definitely looking forward to this album, the way you're talking it up, so I want to have you back on once I hear this thing. Is there anything else you want to promote, or do you have websites you want to share with the listeners?
Well, yeah, I do. I'm on Facebook like 5 days a week. I talk to all of my Whiplash followers on there, and that's facebook.com, tonypertaro.usa, and also we have Whiplash page. It's facebook.com, Whiplash page, and the official Whiplash site is officialwhiplash.com.
All right, yeah. So with that, Tony, I'd like to thank you for joining me here on Third Eye Cinema, and we'd love to have you back on when your next album drops.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Thanks, Gene.
Take care.
Bye.
And to close out our interview with Tony, here's another one from Whiplash. Stay tuned after the close for one more from Whiplash. But right now, it's time to stage dive. Contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker, musician, would like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back. promise. Here's one final track from Whiplash off Ticket to Mayhem. This is Respect the Dead. If you missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience.